Good afternoon. Welcome to the Eco News Report. I'm your host this week, Scott Greeson, North Coast Director of Friends of the Eel River. The Eco News Report is an exclusive feature of KHSU, brought to you by the North Coast Environmental Center, publisher of our regional environmental newspaper, the Eco News. Don't forget, you can find this show and other KHSU public affairs shows on the audio archives page at khsu.org. Even in this wettest corner of the continent, and yes, Honeydew Mountain gets more rain than any other place in the lower 48, if one pays attention to environmental issues, one is not infrequently reminded of the adage often attributed to Mark Twain that whiskey is for drinking and water for fighting over. The Eel River, the great lost river of this lost coast, has been the scene of one of the greatest fights over a dam that never came to be, but continues to bear the impacts of a very early dam project, the Potter Valley Project, that to this day diverts most of the upper basin's summer flows through a tunnel through the ridge that separates the Eel Basin from the upper Russian River. Today, we'll be talking about some of the issues that link the Russian and Eel Basins. Gravel mining, threatened and endangered salmon and steelhead, and frost protection pumping for grape vineyards are just some of the issues that both divide and connect these neighboring watersheds. With us on the phone from Petaluma to discuss these issues is David Keller, my cohort as Bay Area Director for Friends of the Eel River. David is an advocate for public trust resources and good government. He's a former Petaluma City Councilman, a founder of the Petaluma River Council, and was named the Sonoma County's Environmentalist of the Year for 2009. Hi, David. Thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me on.
Yeah. Well, maybe the place to start with this story for folks here on the North Coast is the upper North Coast, I should say, is with the Russian River and what's happened both to the river itself and its flows as well as its watershed over the course of the 20th century. You know, roughly speaking, how's it changed from 1911 to 2011?
Well, with the construction of the Potter Valley Project, actually in 1908, water from the Eel River was diverted into the East Fork of the Russian River and provided a perennial flow. At that point, it was seasonal. It was run of the river. And then when, given the small dam there, Van Arsdale, when Lake Pillsbury was built in the early 1920s, the ability to transfer water from the Eel to the Russian became year-round, since the water could be stored in Lake Pillsbury and released to go through the Potter Valley tunnels to the generators and then into the East Branch Russian River. What that meant is that the upper and middle reaches of the Russian River went essentially from seasonal surface flows to perennial surface flows, so that the surface flow in the Russian River was inconsistent. In heavy rain years, you'd have connected surface flows all the way down. But in the drier years, in average dry years, the water would go down below surface level, travel, of course, in the wonderful gravel aquifer of the Russian River, so there'd be a great subsurface flow of cold, clean water that would fill and replenish and flow through all of the deep pools. Great habitat for salmonids, for coho, chinook, and steelhead. When the surface flows were augmented by the Eel River flows, the Russian River began to flow all year round as a surface flow river. And that, of course, set the stage for allowing pike minnow, which were native in the lower Russian River, to start moving upstream. And upstream they moved. They're very vigorous predators of salmonid. An adult pike minnow can eat 15 juvenile salmon per day. And so that changed what was happening for the salmon and steelhead of the Russian River. When you combine that with later practices of gravel mining, particularly after World War II, the entire topography of the Russian River began to change dramatically.
So how has gravel extraction been linked to flows in the Russian River? What's been the effect of gravel mining in the Russian?
Well, if you were to ask the Sonoma County Board of Supervisors or probably the Mendocino County Board of Supervisors who regulate gravel mining, they'd say there's no problem. However, if you were to look at the science of it, you'd find that what happens is that when you remove gravel from the aquifer of the Russian River, a couple of very important changes and very damaging changes happen. One is you lose water, and the other is you lose clean water. And here's how it works. The Russian River is one of the great gravel-bred aquifer rivers of western U.S. Gravel bed is thick, it's wide, and gravel and sands and cobbles that fill this bed are porous. they are about 30 to 50% porous, so that space gets filled with water. And so every winter, this huge reservoir is filled with water. When you gravel mine, you're removing essentially that reservoir. You're removing the ability of the gravel to hold water by removing the gravel itself. It's like cutting off pieces of a sponge. You eventually find that you have less and less water can be absorbed in that sponge, and that's exactly what's happened in the Russian River aquifer from the middle reach all the way down.
So do we have a rough idea of how much storage has been lost?
Yeah. Bob Curry, hydrologist at UC Santa Cruz, has estimated that since World War II, some 400,000 acre feet of water storage in the Russian River aquifer have been lost to gravel mining. That's about three times the amount of water stored in Lake Mendocino, double the size of Lake Sonoma, meaning that the Russian River watershed's ability to store water and release that water as cold, clear water throughout the year has been reduced substantially. And that is not a permanent loss, but as long as gravel mining continues, that gravel and sand and cobbles cannot be rebuilt. The gravel industry always says, well, we're just going to take what's coming in. But the river is already in deficit and has lost this huge amount of water storage. That can be gained back by ceasing gravel mining in the tributaries and in the main stem and letting the Russian River naturally replenish itself. And that can be, there are some ways to begin to do that a little bit faster, but essentially that would be the process. The other thing that gets lost is water quality. The Sonoma County Water Agency's water supply, which is mostly from the Russian River itself, is deemed clean enough by the State Department of Health since 1949 to only require chlorination in the pipes to prevent infection in the pipes. But the filtration capabilities of the sand and gravel of the Russian River aquifer provide natural filtration. This is one of the largest naturally filtered water supplies left in the country as a municipal water supply. And by taking that filtration media out by gravel mining, you're losing the river's ability to filter all the contaminants that come into it. And so it's actually extremely damaging, and that value of that service for how much, what is it worth to filter the water? At some point, the Sonoma County Water Agency was looking at constructing a water filtration plant to be able to take water directly out of Lake Sonoma. And the cost for that 10 years ago was $500 to $700 million. And that's, of course, a plant life of maybe 50, 60, 70 years at the most. So that's a repeating cost. And then if you add inflation, financing costs, it's well over $1 billion to filter the water that goes into the Sonoma County Water Agency supply. That service is now provided for free by nature, by the Russian River watershed. So you lose it. There is a real cost. The cost of gravel mining has never been truly assessed on the gravel miners. They're essentially taking this rock for free. And the loss to the river, to the fish, to the water quality, water filtration services is never paid.
So, David, you've suggested that the Russian River has lost water storage as well as water quality, and we should talk about the impacts on salmon and steelhead in the Russian. But what are the other impacts of gravel mining that we know of?
Well, they in places in the lower middle reach down by Guerneville, and the bed of the Russian River has dropped as much as 25 feet from where it was 50 years ago, which means that bridge piers, foundations, roads, banks all are eroded and start moving. The bridge up by Geyserville has shifted as the foundation has been disturbed through the loss of the natural cement that kept it in place, meaning the gravel. So there's losses in erosion to the tributary streams. When the main stem of the Russian is dropped below the entrance level from those tributary streams, the fish have a hard time getting up there, and those areas tend to dry out. The subsurface flows prevent fish from getting up the tributaries, so you prevent fish passage. Also, by leveling out the bed of the Russian River, you make it wide and flat so it gets hotter. Not good for salmonids, great for pike minnow. And you also fill in and level out all of those deep water pools that the fish need during the summer and early fall for surviving where the cold water flows are. And by running graders and bulldozers through that material, you're not only compacting it, you're also destroying that those kind of pools and riffles that the fish need. You're also compacting it. You're adding a tremendous amount of silt, which tends to clog the gravels, which makes it much more difficult for salmon and steelhead to spawn. And in the gravel mining process, you're also releasing methyl mercury, which is toxic both to fish and to humans. So all around, there is no good that can come of gravel mining in a fish-bearing river.
So that gets us to the question of salmon and steelhead in the Russian River. There was a huge recreational fishery in the Russian River, as I understand it, well into the 1960s. What's the situation today for coho and steelhead in the Russian watershed?
Well, you now have coho, steelhead, and chinook all listed as threatened species, which means that you can't keep them. So you can catch and release if you're willing to do that, or for many people who don't want to harm the fish that are there, you're not even really capable of doing that. So what once was one of the great fish-bearing rivers of the coast is down to countable fish. It's not good. There are fish hatcheries. Fish and Game and Water Agency are doing fish hatcheries, but that doesn't provide the long-term sustainable, and by sustainable I mean forever, ability for that river to bear fish plentiful enough to survive forever without us having to tend each one. When you have to give each fish a name and tend them individually, you know you're in trouble.
Right. So if you're just tuning in, this is the Eco News Report. I'm Scott Greeson, North Coast Director of Friends of the Eel River. I'm talking today with David Keller, the Bay Area Director for Friends of the Eel River. And we're talking about, so far, issues on the Russian River watershed and some of the connections between issues in the Russian and the eel watersheds. David, you suggested that Sonoma and Mendocino counties have not been eager to address the impacts of gravel mining.
That is correct. Yeah, no, in fact, the Sonoma County Board of Supervisors is the Board of Directors for the Sonoma County Water Agency. It's only one of only about maybe two or three such agencies. Board of Supervisors serve as directors of the Water Agency. And there's too many conflicts of interest in information, in time, in alliances, in where the money flows, so that I'm told that the Board of Supervisors of the county of Sonoma County have not asked, for instance, staff of the Water Agency to comment on the impacts of gravel mining on the water supply, which is kind of bizarre.
Given what you just told us about the cost to replace that filtration,
So that the Board of Supervisors had said, well, we're going to end gravel mining in the Russian River, but they just granted permits for SIAR to pick up where they left off late last year. Russian Riverkeeper and Sierra Club have sued on that, and that is slowly wending its way through the courts. But the practices are still damaging. And similarly, Mendocino County supervisors don't seem to have any inclination to prohibit gravel mining in rivers and in the river and in the tributaries, particularly the salmon-bearing tribs.
David, I've heard it suggested recently by Bill Keir, a sometime guest on this show and a fisheries guy who's been following the science and politics of gravel mining for much of the last 50 years, that Humboldt County now appears poised to become the gravel source for a significant part of the West Coast. Given the experience of the Russian, do you think we've got cause for concern on the eel, the Van Dusen, the Mad, the Trinity, the Klamath?
Absolutely. According to a textbook case, in study of Western gravel mining in rivers, and this was done by Jeff Mount, who just was the geology chair at UC Davis. There's a great book called California Rivers and Streams, if your listeners want to go out and find a copy. Again, California Rivers and Streams by Jeff Mount. And what he notes in there is that despite all the promises and regulatory setups to limit gravel mining in Western rivers, in reality, that doesn't happen. And so when the mining industry says, well, we're just going to take out what's surplus, what's replenished every year, the fact is that those numbers are always skewed in the industry's favor, and the ability and willingness of the regulatory agencies or the granting agencies, meaning the counties, to regulate the actual amount of gravel coming out and keep it within limits is always pushed to the edge of their capabilities or over the edge of their capabilities, such as gravel mining. Once they're in, they don't get out.
And why is that?
It's a huge economic driver. And, of course, gravel, we all use sand and gravel. And the gravel industry, of course, is connected to the heavy construction and construction industries, the building industries, the development industries. And that is, of course, as we all know, a huge driver in politics everywhere. And so when the money comes in from those folks, when the lobbyists come in from that group of constituents, when campaigns are financed by that group of constituents, when they're closely allied with the newspapers and other forms of publicity, it's hard to get a word in edgewise, and it's hard to get staff and the politicians to actually act in support of the rivers, because the people who are speaking for the rivers don't have that kind of money and don't have that kind of political connection, or at least they haven't had. That's our job, is to try and balance that out. So as a result, the shall we say, the overfishing of gravel mining in all of our rivers in the western U.S. has always exceeded the river's capability of maintaining itself. Riverbeds drop, water levels go down, water tables go down in adjacent land as the riverbed drops. There are all kinds of nasty consequences that are larger than the gravel mining. And when they focus strictly on the gravel mining's impact on a very localized parcel, for instance, and don't take a look at what happens upstream and downstream as you start removing that gravel, that rock, what is the bed load of the river, what the water wants to move, they don't take a larger look, or they're not interested in it, or it's done administratively over the counter. Those larger picture questions are never asked, and the answers, when they're tossed into the mix, are usually overshadowed by loud voices from the construction industry. It's a hard one to manage, so that certainly one could make the case that, well, maybe there is some sustainable amount of rock that could come out of the Eel River or the Mad River. What is that number? Who decides what that number is? Where is it coming from? Who manages it? How is that maintained? Who oversees it? The actual practical administrative questions of that are not usually answerable in any way that's going to serve the river and its population of fish.
So we've been talking about gravel mining and fish, particularly in the Russian River watershed. We need to shift gears now and address another angle of the issues that unite and divide the Russian and the Eel watersheds. And this is the frost protection pumping that's been happening in the Russian River. So, David, what is frost protection irrigation? Why is it a problem for fish in the Russian River?
Sure. With the proliferation of grapes, we see all kinds of conversions of forest land and timberland to grapes. It's a high-value crop, high-cachet crop, a lot of investment money coming in, thousands of acres being funded in new plantings by investors from out of the state, out of the area, who say, I want a winery, I want my summer home on a hilltop overlooking this great winery. It's cheaper than France, and I can do it right here, and I've got the money to do it. So we're seeing, aside from the economics of the wine industry itself, which are booming, relatively speaking, relative to other crops, a lot of conversion of land to grapes.
And we're talking, in many cases, about forest land there.
Yep. Certainly former ag lands, hay fields, and other crops are being torn out. Apples, pears, cherries, plums, and other crops have been torn out and replaced with grapes. And we're also seeing, as you say, a lot of timberland conversion upslope and in areas that had never been planted before. And it's pretty destructive when you take out redwoods and you've got to rip that soil, get rid of the roots, sterilize the soil, terrace it, and amend it so you can start growing this high-value crop. But in the early spring, as the grapevines are putting out their buds and also their new leaves, they're very susceptible to frost. And when temperatures get below, say, 26 degrees, it's going to provide permanent damage to that year's crop, both in leaf damage and in bud damage. So one of the ways of dealing with that to try and keep them from freezing, keep them from being damaged by frost, is to the old way with smudge pots, wind machines, and what has happened in the past 30 or 40 years is the really heavy use of frost irrigation. Essentially what happens is as the temperature is dropping and it hits about 35, 34 degrees in anticipation of hitting that freezing mark, growers will have overhead sprayers that are essentially misting over hundreds or thousands of acres of grapes in an area that might be subject to frost, so that the buds and new leaves get coated with water that freezes first, and that provides actually an insulating layer between the falling air temperature and the bud and new leaf growth. And that's good down to about 26 degrees. So they can actually buy themselves maybe 6 to 8 degrees temperature drop without damage to the crop. That requires a huge amount of water. To get that spray irrigation, they'll use about 50 gallons per minute per acre. A 100-acre vineyard, if you add all of that up, it's 4 to 6 acre-feet of water. Now you're talking real water. And when you have an area that has hundreds of acres or several thousand acres of frost-prone crop, and they're all using this overhead sprinkling to try and forestall frost damage, now you're using hundreds of acre-feet of water or thousands of acre-feet of water, and then if that frost period lasts more than one night, keep multiplying it. Frost periods can last one night, they can last 14, 20 nights, and it depends on where you planted, what happens with that particular weather, whether you've planted the grapes upslope, which tend to drain the cold air down, or as has happened in Russian River Valley, Alexander Valley particularly, among others, with the advent of frost sprinkling, the frost use of frost water, areas are planted that never would have been planted in grapes before because they freeze first. And so the grape industry has essentially used free water, what they perceived as free water, with bigger pumps to plant this high-value crop in areas that maybe should not have been planted or should have had other crops that are less susceptible to frost at that period of time.
And what has been the consequence for the Russian River's threatened endangered fish?
When there is a large enough area in a tributary stream or subwatershed, enough water can be pumped out overnight to dry that stream up. And, of course, this is early springtime. The steelhead and other fry are just out there, and all of a sudden their water disappears, and they're stranded. There have been verified fish kills of protected species, verified by National Marine Fisheries Service and by Fish and Game, and that is illegal. It's a take. It's against federal law. And the grape growers have insisted, no, 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 that didn't actually happen, or it was just an errant accident, not a problem. And for years, there have been arguments back and forth with the state and the State Water Resources Control Board, which regulates water rights and use of water, over whether or not they need to be regulated.
And in fact, you mentioned that the National Marine Fisheries Service biologists have said there's a take, which is a prohibited act under the Endangered Species Act. You're not allowed to take a endangered species without a permit, but they've actually gone further and they've said that if this continues, there is jeopardy to the survival of these listed species.
Exactly.
And that, you know, there's no higher alarm they could raise.
Yep.
So what have the state and county done to prevent these fish kills from happening going forward?
Well, there's been a lot of back and forth at the state level. Again, this, in California, water belongs to the people. That's part of our Constitution. The right to use water, a water right, is granted by the state and has to be for reasonable and beneficial use. That's, again, part of our Constitution. So the state is empowered to protect this public trust, which is the water and everything that thrives with it, meaning the fish, the plant life, all the biotic species in the water and adjacent to the water. So the state has been struggling to figure out what to do with it. And, of course, the grape industry has been arguing that they don't want to be regulated. What else is new? This past year, the state finally said there will be regulations coming down. We have to prevent this from happening. We have to provide some basis of regulating the use of this water for frost control. Otherwise, it is not a beneficial use of water, and we will not permit it. It will be a violation of the state's constitution. We will prosecute.
Nonetheless, there's been another frost protection fish kill this spring.
Yep. And the grape growers, in concert with former supervisor Paul Kelly in Sonoma County, instead decided they were going to try and preempt the state, knowing that the state was going to come out with some kind of regulations, that NMFS was breathing down their necks. They crafted their own special little program in secret to provide for regulation of frost control water in Sonoma County. This would not affect how Mendocino dealt with it, but certainly in the Russian River watershed, Sonoma County was going to try and take the lead, written and handed to them on a silver platter by the grape industry. As I said, this was done secretly. We were only tipped off to it. It took months for us to actually get any response from the county and started to be provided any of the documents. When we saw what was there, it was such a loose picture of self-regulation. Monitoring, stream gauging, that data was essentially going to be held confidential. We would see a report once a year. The data would be held by a private corporation set up by grape industry players called the Russian River Water Conservation Council. And again, the public, other stakeholders, downstream water rights holders, the downstream property owners, fisheries, tribal rights, nobody else was invited in, and in fact, Sonoma County worked really hard to exclude us. We got into it. We were able to defeat the first round, and as a result, Sonoma County has required only a registration process where anybody using frost water has to register with the county that they are going to be using frost water. They refused, however, to ask whether or not the applicants for this registration even have legal water rights.
Stunning.
Because they said that's not our problem, that's the state's.
Right. So speaking of other interests, but I'd ask two questions as a sort of follow-up. One is, can you tie this back together with the story of the Eel River's water that's being diverted into the Russian? How does that play into the frost protection reality? And then what can people do, and where should they be paying attention?
You bet. The connection between the demand for water in the Russian River and what happens on the Eel River are very close and very important. And for a lot of folks in Humboldt, Upper Mendocino County, you're going, well, all right, so they're screwing up the Russian. So what? By over-appropriating, by taking more water out of the Russian River than naturally flows into it, by diminishing its storage capacity in its gravel bed aquifer, by continuing grape practices that overdraft the Russian River, the Eel River is used to mask that overdrafting. So when the Russian River would have run dry, the reason there's still water in the Russian River is because the Eel River's water is diverted through the Powder Valley Project into Lake Mendocino, and that water is used to mop up the damages from the grape growers, from the municipal water users, and anybody else who's got a straw in the Russian River without a permit and is causing damage to the fish. More water has been lost in storage by gravel mining the Russian River's aquifer in the past 60 years than comes from the Eel River. If Sonoma County's cities and farms were to let that gravel start increasing again, they could capture more water in the Russian River watershed itself than they're taking from the Eel River. It would help the Russian River's ecosystem, it would help the fish, and it would help our water supply. And we could let the Eel River go free. So the Eel River suffers to keep the Russian River looking like it's real.
So again, where can people get more information about this?
Okay, the frost protection rules will come to a public hearing in September. If folks go online to the State Water Resources Control Board, they'll see under pending actions and pending decisions, Russian River frost control, and all the documentation and the notices of public meetings will be there. Please come and speak for the Eel River, speak for the fisheries. I know it's a long trip to Sacramento in September, but otherwise most of the people in the audience speaking to the State Water Resources Control Board members are grape growers. The other thing that would be very helpful on a forever basis is to write letters to the Santa Rosa Press Democrat. And the address on that would be by email, letters@pressdemocrat.com. We want our fish back. Give us back our water. We very rarely hear voices from the North Coast, and yet the practices here in Sonoma County affect what happens in the North Coast and the Eel River. People in the Eel River are well aware that we're taking water to mop up the damages in the Russian River, and enough of that. You want the fish back in the Eel River. You want the water back in the Eel River. There are more people in California who are not on the Russian River system who are affected by this. And Sonoma County residents, Sonoma County politicians, and the regulatory agencies need to hear from you.
Thank you so much, David. Really appreciate you coming on today.
Thank you very much. Appreciate the time with your audience. Thank you, Scott.
Talk to you soon.
Bye-bye.
So this has been the Eco News Report. My name is Scott Greeson. I'm the North Coast Director for the Friends of the Eel River, and I've been your host for the past half hour. My guest today was David Keller, the Bay Area Director for Friends of the Eel River. If you'd like to replay this interview or share it with others, you can go to the Public Affairs page on the KHSU website at khsu.org, where these programs are archived for 2 weeks after they air. Thereafter, the files from recent shows are posted on the North Coast Environmental Center's website at yournec.org. If you have any questions or comments about this program, please call KHSU's listener comment line at 826-6089. The Eco News Report is produced for KHSU, located at Humboldt State University, in cooperation with the North Coast Environmental Center, and is engineered by the indefatigable Fred McLaughlin. Join us again next Thursday at 1:30 here on KHSU for the Eco News Report.